Good morning. Welcome to Cases from the Community, integrating new research findings into practice. So this is a multi-tumor symposium in partnership with the American Oncology Network. Dr. Neil Love is not going to be here as part of the research to practice in person this year. So I will. He will be present on video, but I'll be serving as the moderator. I'm Fred Divers. First of all, I want to welcome and thank the American Oncology Network members for their participation in this program. I also want to thank the partnership between American Oncology Network and MEBA, Meaningful Insights in Biotech Analytics. This is an AI company. We'll be using a portion of the data they extracted from the American Oncology Network to provide some level of relevance for the data that we'll be reviewing in the spaces provided. Obviously, want to thank our commercial supporters here, including AbbVie, Astellas, AZ, Bristol-Myers, CT Bio, Daiichi, Geron, GSK, Insight, Natera, Pfizer, and Taiho. The planners, the scientific staff, and independent reviewers for research to practice have no relevant conflicts of interest to disclose here. Again, this is an educational activity with CME credit. We will be discussing non-FDA-approved uses of agents and regimens. We would ask that you please refer to the official prescribing information for each product for any of the approved indications here. So we're going to go ahead and get started with cases from the community, again, integrating new research into clinical practice from the American Oncology Network. We have a number of medical oncologists who have contributed cases and will be interviewed, so you'll see these actual live video feeds from them. I want to thank Dr. Boucher, Dr. Noble, Dr. Lamar, Dr. Mulheron, Dr. Patel, and Dr. Warsh regarding the cases and time that they spent with Neil Love on the interviews today and participation with our experts. This is a brief snapshot. I told you we'd be looking at data from MEBA, the database regarding the patients within AON, just to give you an overview. We're going to be discussing six different modules today, including lung cancer, myelodysplastic syndromes, and myelofibrosis and leukemias, as well as GYN, hepatocellular, and biliary tract cancers, and colorectal cancer. This gives you some idea about the volume of patients and depth and breadth of the network, as well as specific biomarker mutations within those patients. So we're going to go ahead and get started with module one. This is going to be dedicated to antibody-drug conjugates and lung cancer. Love to welcome Dr. Edward Guerin. Very appreciative for your presence here today. So Dr. Guerin's a professor, director of the Thoracic Oncology Program at the David Geffen School of Medicine in UCLA in Los Angeles. Very appreciative for you taking the time to be here with us today and answer some intriguing questions. One, antibody drug conjugates in the lung cancer space. These are Dr. Guerin's disclosures and mine. This is a brief snapshot, again, of some MEBA data with respect to small cell patients in the network and with respect to EGFR mutation status throughout the network as a whole, and also HER2 overexpression. Again, these are sort of queuing up what we would be talking about from targets on the antibody drug conjugates. Also, the percentage of patients treated with osimertinib who have actionable EGFR mutations, and the number of patients enrolled in clinical trials. Also, we'll be addressing the utilization of trastuzumab, deruxtecan, in the patients within the network. And the newer regimen, the bispecific T-cell engager, tarlatamab, again, in the small cell patient population.
Good morning, everyone. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love from Research to Practice and our virtual case library. Today, focusing on cases and questions from the practices of six American Oncology Network medical oncologists, Drs. Ralph Boccia, Gina Noble, Zanetta Lamar, Brian Mulheron, Terrell Patel, and Sean Wersch, who met with me recently to present cases and questions to challenge our faculty all day long, beginning with a case from Dr. Mulheron and follow-up questions from Dr. Boccia.
This is a 69-year-old lady, a never smoker, who presented with dyspnea, weight loss, cough, 3.5 centimeter right upper lobe nodule, liver mets, adrenal metastasis, bone mets, and 2 small cerebellar metastases. Adenocarcinoma, PD-L1 positive at 20%. She had a HER2 mutation and started first-line carboplatin, pemetrexed, pembrolizumab, did receive stereotactic radiosurgery to her cerebellar metastases, and is now on T-DXd and is fortunately responding well.
Any questions for the faculty?
Right now, we have T-DXd approved in the second line. What about using it in the front line? And let's say she was HER2 positive by expression, by IHC. What do you think about using T-DXd in those cases?
Any questions about T-DXd?
Is the toxicity in patients with lung cancer who may or may not have been exposed to radiation before any different than it is in breast cancer patients who weren't exposed to it? Are there specific precautions that we need to take? Are there certain patients we should avoid treating that are at much higher risk? Is it safe if you pick up a grade 1 ILD to retreat that patient? Because if you get a scan, the patient's responding, and here you have a grade 1 ILD, you got to ask the question, should you go back on it or not? If the patient's responding, that's a difficult patient not to offer it to.
So questions for our faculty. I appreciate Dr. Boucher and Dr. Mulhern. They brought up great points. So should all patients with lung cancer, number one, be tested for HER2 overexpression? Dr. Guerin? For patients with non-small cell lung cancer and a HER2 mutation, does the response rate and the data that we're going to see with T-DXd justify first-line utilization in this space? Are you offering that? And to Dr. Boucher's point, with respect to ILD in a lung cancer patient, a little different from a breast cancer patient, are you permanently discontinuing that after resolution of those symptoms?
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for having me. I will be discussing some of the data from trastuzumab deruxtecan after this, and in fact, of the things we're going to talk about, trastuzumab deruxtecan is really the only one that is approved. So in terms of should all patients with lung cancer be tested for HER2 overexpression, I think in an ideal world, yes. I think one of the things that's problematic is that increasingly we're having significant demands on our tumor tissue. And so I would say that my priority still would be performing next-generation sequencing to get all the data available. But in an ideal world, particularly at a time when really the only antibody-drug conjugate approved in lung cancer is trastuzumab deruxtecan, it probably does make sense to be testing all patients. We certainly have tested for much rarer subsets of patients in the past, although this is going to be a fairly rare subset who will be 3+ by IHC, certainly in the single digits in terms of percentages. I think that the question as to whether or not the response rate justifies first-line treatment, what I would say is that on some level, response rate alone can never justify sort of moving something into an earlier line of treatment. What we're really interested in is whether or not you're going to have improvements in the longitudinal outcomes, whether people are going to ideally live longer or at very least have their disease controlled longer. There are ongoing clinical trials that are assessing this question specifically. And in my own practice, I am not using this as a frontline therapy, although in all fairness, we do have the clinical trial of trastuzumab deruxtecan versus chemoimmunotherapy. And I think of these three questions, the last question is actually the most difficult, which is at what level of ILD are you permanently discontinuing treatment with trastuzumab deruxtecan? One of the things is that after there were significant risks of interstitial lung disease, including deaths in some patients, the clinical trials of these agents became extraordinarily conservative. And as a result, very limited amounts of interstitial lung disease were really exclusionary for additional treatment. I think that Dr. Boucher had asked a question about are there differences between lung cancer patients and breast cancer patients? I think that that in some of these cases, there may be a little less pulmonary reserve. The HER2 mutation positive patients tend not to have been smokers. They don't have the same lung disease that you would see in a generalized lung cancer population. However, still there is some lung disease. What I would say is the clinical trials required it to be discontinued, but I'm going to take a little bit of a cop-out answer here. I think that the decision in clinical practice is going to be more based on what we do with all of our decisions, which is that we assess the potential risks as well as the potential benefits. I think that one would be much more reluctant to go back to trastuzumab deruxtecan with a grade 1 ILD if you are using it in a frontline setting. On the other hand, if you have a patient who is previously treated and your alternatives are less good, I think we may become a little more aggressive about re-challenging, although I would say we do have to do that with caution. We really have very little clinical trial data to guide us, even in these fairly asymptomatic radiographic changes associated with ILD.
Great. Yeah, I think highlighting the differences in the breast and the lung space and the patient population with respect to HER2 is intriguing, and thanks for shedding some light on that.
Yeah, and thank you very much for having me. We'll go through some formal slides as well as the cases as described. Lung cancer talks on antibody drug conjugates, you know, generally start out with this slide depicting the structure where you would have an antibody which is attached to by a linker to a drug. But in many respects, that's because in lung cancer, this is a fairly new therapeutic approach, whereas for people who have a more general practice, these are agents that people have been using for a long period of time already. As I mentioned, really the only approved agent at this point is trastuzumab deruxtecan. It was originally approved on early phase data that looked at patients with a HER2 mutation. I always like to point out, although people are often familiar, this is different than what you see in breast cancer. In breast cancer, you have amplification of the HER2 gene, whereas in lung cancer, it is mutations. Typically, it is sort of a duplication that you'll see in exon 20, although there are additional mutations that you can see. Here you can see the original data with a very impressive-looking waterfall plot. You can see some of the molecular characteristics, looking at the mutation, expression, amplifications, as well as prior therapies. And you can see that there was really shrinkage in nearly all of the patients with a very high response rate. One thing when asking, again, to address the question of differences between lung and breast, this became somewhat confusing for practitioners. The dose that was used in this study was higher than the dose that was used for breast cancer. And so eventually, a dose comparison study was performed looking at the dose that was originally tested in lung cancer, the 6.4 milligram per kilogram, versus the dosing that was already approved for breast cancer, 5.4 milligram per kilogram. And the data really looked very similar with respect to efficacy, but there was a clear improvement in tolerability at the 5.4 milligram per kilogram dose. And so, interestingly, the FDA had this data so that even though the only published data at the time of the approval was on the 6.4 milligram per kilogram, the approval is at the same dose as what is used in breast cancer, the 5.4. Trastuzumab deruxtecan now is also approved in patients who have 3+ by IHC for HER2. This occurred on April 5th. The patients need to be those who have received prior systemic therapy and don't really have good alternative treatment options. You can see that the trial design, this is actually an extensive trial looking at multiple different agents, generally with AstraZeneca's pipeline, looking at incorporation of durvalumab, as well as some other immunotherapy type approaches. But the approval is based on a monotherapy cohort. You can see arm 1D. This is quite small, and this was looking across multiple histologies, but this is the lung-specific data. Again, you can see that they looked at patients with HER2 2+ and 3+. The data for 2+ looks reasonably good, but the data for 3+ here, you can see over 50% of the patients had an objective response. Now, I will caution you that that over 50% is 9 people, but this is some of the data we have, and again, it's combined with data from other histologies on this IHC 3+ population. The duration of response in these IHC 3+ patients is over a year, with an impressive median progression-free survival as well.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that, you know, that you've got the mutation status, but also those 3+ expressors, and sort of apples and oranges. We have another case here with Dr. Patel.
The next case was presented by Dr. Patel.
59-year male diagnosed metastatic adenocarcinoma found to have EGFR mutation. He has a brain mass that was taken care of first with the radiation or CyberKnife, then followed by systemic treatment with osimertinib, and patient was doing very well. Then he has a progressive disease, and we added the chemotherapy. And now he has a progressive disease, mainly in the brain, so we don't know what to do. And now we have a lot of new agent out there. What the best thing we should do, since patient has already failed chemotherapy, one EGFR inhibitor, what the next we should do? I was going to send him for second opinion, but where we are right now with the newer approval of AmbiVet.
What about patritumab deruxtecan, the HER3 antibody drug conjugate, currently unapproved, but with a lot of really exciting data in the EGFR mutant recurrence setting?
Where appropriately used, what are the toxicity and what the management? And that's what I had said, listen, we can do this, but maybe good idea to get the second opinion or look for clinical trial.
So, questions for you, Dr. Guerin. If patritumab deruxtecan were currently available, where in the treatment sequence would you envision employing it for those patients with EGFR mutation positive disease? You know, historically, there was a desert for answers once you progressed on your initial TKI. And then secondarily, what are the most common toxicities that you've noticed with this with the antibody drug conjugate to HER3? And if you had HER3 DXD, Dato DXD, both available, well, how would you sequence those two agents here?
Yeah, what I might do, if you're okay with it, is wait and discuss the questions at the end on this one. And the reason being that, unlike trastuzumab deruxtecan, where there's familiarity from the audience, there's less familiarity here. So I want to go through the data underlying this first. One thing that I will start by mentioning is that one of the things that I think is quite different amongst patients who treat lung cancer in as their main career versus people who do some lung cancer, we tend to be very reluctant to at least initially look at whole brain radiation. And I think that's because as our systemic treatments have improved a great deal, unfortunately, many of us have had cases where our patients who are doing well from a cancer perspective basically die a dementia death, which is quite striking and miserable for the patient, their family, and difficult to watch. So what I would say is we do have reluctance. What I would say is on this case, if somebody is having progressive disease after they've already received EGFR-directed therapy like osimertinib, whole brain radiation does become a consideration. Now let's get to the data on the antibody-drug conjugates in this setting. So the Herthena lung study looked at patritumab deruxtecan. So again, the payload or chemotherapeutic agent here is the same as trastuzumab deruxtecan. So deruxtecan is the payload, but the antibody is directed against HER3, which has been evaluated reasonably to date in particularly EGFR mutant disease. I'm not going to get too into the biology today. You can see this is data largely on early phase study. You can see patients were treated with 5.6 milligrams per kilogram, and the enrollment was 225 patients. There's a lot of data on this slide. I would actually say it probably makes the most sense to look at the subset with prior third generation EGFR TKI and platinum based chemotherapy. So that's basically the last column of numbers. The study did include some people who had not received a third generation EGFR inhibitor, but in our practice today, the subset, which is nearly all the patients who had received it, is probably more relevant. You can see that the response rate is about 30% in these patients, and the duration of response I would say is good, but maybe not spectacular, at 6.4 months. With a reasonable overall survival that you see. When you look at the subset analyses, really you are seeing sort of across the board efficacy. There are not clear subgroups that are or are not benefiting. This is a complicated slide. This is looking at the waterfall plot, which obviously is the easier part of it. You can see a fairly high degree of activity. The focus was on patients with the traditional sensitizing mutations, EGFR exon 19 deletions, or the point mutation in exon 21, L858R. You can see the resistance mechanism is listed below. Now, this is a little bit interesting because in many respects, one might say this doesn't have a huge relevance yet in clinical practice. EGFR-dependent resistance mechanisms, for instance, would be things like the C797S mutation, which prevents osimertinib from binding. EGFR-independent would be like a patient I saw the other day who had a KRAS mutation develop while on EGFR inhibition. And many patients, the resistance mechanism to their TKI was unknown. One thing that is actually, I would say, complicated this field quite significantly is the lack of a biomarker. And this is true for multiple of the deruxtecan-based compounds. Interestingly, HER2, the biomarker, at least for lung cancer cases, is pretty clear. You have EGFR mutations, which have done quite well as 3+ by IHC. But for TROP2, which we'll talk about later, as well as HER3, it's been a little bit hard to define what the biomarker is. And I would argue this a little bit undercuts the discussion we give to the patients. We tend to have a pretty well-educated patient population. You explain the idea of this sort of being a smart bomb. You have the payload attacked to an antibody. The antibody goes to the payload and then the antigen, and then it attacks just the cancer cells. And so then the patients in my clinical sometimes ask, well, how much HER3 do I have? And then you say, oh, don't worry about it. It doesn't matter. And some of them will ask why, and then you sort of try and change the subject. Because our explanations do fall down a little bit on this. You can see that maybe
you got to get there anyway on the off-target side effects, right? So
it's right. I guess right. It's your transition to toxicity, right? It's you strategize. How do you deal with a follow-up question you can't adequately answer? Right. Yeah, exactly. So you know, you can maybe convince yourself looking at this data that maybe the levels are a little lower in the progressive disease cases, but statistically, this isn't very compelling, and I think has been a complicating factor for the disease. You have started to see more complex biomarkers that people have looked at, but I would say nothing to date. Getting back to our case, intracranial responses have been seen with trastuzumab deruxtecan, with patritumab deruxtecan. And I would say this is part of a series of data sets that have come out recently that have basically made all that we told our trainees wrong over the last several years about what would be an effective approach in the brain. We always said, well, chemotherapy isn't much use once there's disease in the brain because it's, you know, most of these are large molecules. They're not going to get to the brain. Certainly an antibody-based therapy is not going to cross the blood-brain barrier. It's a very large molecule. And now between data showing that that you can have quite a bit of efficacy by chemotherapy as well as osimertinib in brain metastases, the bispecific antibody or the antibody amivantamab in this setting, as well as antibody drug conjugates such as patritumab, deruxtecan, indicates that maybe this blood-brain barrier is not necessarily the crucial thing that leads to whether or not someone has benefit in the brain. And you can see that there were patients who had basically brain metastases that you could follow, and the response rate was reasonably good in these cases. You can see an example here. Toxicity profile, it's a little bit different. The GI toxicities are more significant. Thrombocytopenia is also quite real. Stomatitis, which we'll talk about more when we talk about datopotamab deruxtecan, has not been as problematic with this. There is a study that is evaluating this in patients who have progressed on one or two lines of prior EGFR TKI. They're randomized to patritumab deruxtecan versus platinum-based chemotherapy. And we do have a press release at this point that says that there is a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival versus doublet chemotherapy as part of this study. I would say that we're going to need to wait to see the overall data to know how this fits into our overall armamentarium. As people are aware, there is also an approval for amivantamab along with chemotherapy in this setting. And I think there are also are some other interesting data sets that are emerging here. So I think we're going to have to see really what the overall results look like before knowing exactly where this is going to fit into our armamentarium. But certainly before we have this to utilize clinically, we're likely to have that data available. So just to return quickly to any questions I hadn't addressed from the prior, would you like to have access to this? Yes, I think particularly now that we know that from progression-free survival, it hit a statistical endpoint at very least. But in terms of where I would use it, I think it really is going to depend on the data we see.
Perfect. From a sequencing standpoint, from a target, you know, I think we had a meeting yesterday where people were discussing IHC expression for, DXD antibody drug conjugates, and do we really need to look, right, when you get into low and ultra low, and like, is there, so maybe not having a target is the best answer. But from a sequencing standpoint, you don't have any specific preference or specific toxicity that we should look out for in these antibody drug conjugate space?
I mean, I think the one group that we're going to be particularly reluctant to prioritize this are people who have pre-existing interstitial lung disease. I think that we've seen that as a sort of almost a class effect with the deruxtecan-based compounds, so that would lead me to some pause. But otherwise, I just think that for patritumab deruxtecan in particular, it's hard because we're comparing it, for instance, to this regimen called Mariposa 2 of chemotherapy plus amivantamab, but the difference is we have the data for that and we only have a press release here, so I think we can't really compare them yet.
You think we'll see a place where we can get clarity on AMI versus patritumab versus Dato-DXd?
Unfortunately, I don't think it's very likely that we're going to see that data. I think it is going to be a situation like we're all familiar with in sort of frontline non-small cell lung cancer, where you have a bunch of people showing data that compares to a historical control, in this case, chemotherapy, and people are sort of using cross-trial comparisons, which you're always advised against doing, but using cross-trial comparisons to make the decision. The one thing I will also say is that the side effect profile comes in quite significantly, and although in all of my patients in this setting, although I discuss amivantamab along with chemotherapy with them, I have been surprised a very substantial number of my patients choose to go with chemotherapy instead. The progression-free survival was shorter in that arm, but the tolerability is better. And so I think that when we see the patritumab data, people are going to evaluate both the toxicity as well as the efficacy.
Perfect. Next, a video from Dr. Warsh.
The next case, presented by Dr. Warsh, is a 52-year-old man who presented with SVC syndrome and a brain met, and on biopsy had a pulmonary adenocarcinoma without targetable mutations, but with a PD-L1 level of 50%. The patient was initially treated with chemoradiation therapy followed by pembrolizumab.
He was on immunotherapy, tolerating it well. Unfortunately, earlier this year, he had significant progression in the CNS, and at that point, We did whole brain radiation to the multiple CNS lesions, which he tolerated quite well. And then we did a systemic restaging with a PET scan, which you could see on the left. Most of it was localized into the lung cavity, and there's the progression at this mediastinal node. He's already been exposed to a taxane. He's progressed. The questions are, do we look for an alternative chemo regimen or do we rechallenge with immunotherapy? Ultimately, I switched over to ipilimumab nivolumab, and then we could see on the PET scan after 4 months, he had a significant response to the primary, and he's continued on this regimen to this day, and he's doing very well. Sort of in the back of our head, I always think, what would be the next step? There's other newer options, and I think we're waiting on some data about Dato-DXd, if that might be an option down the road, or clinical trial.
Thanks, Dr. Warsh. So, Dr. Guerin, question. This comes up all day, right? I mean, we're used to treating people with a platinum-based doublet plus an IO frontline therapy. So for that patient who progresses after PD-1 antibody in combination with chemotherapy, what is your next go-to regimen?
Yeah, and I think this is an easy question at academic center, which is clinical trial, but the reason that it's clinical trial is because we find the current standard of care pretty unsatisfying. Generally, it would be docetaxel with or without ramucirumab. And one thing I would say, particularly for people who don't treat a lot of lung cancer, we have been very frustrated as a research community on how hard docetaxel has been to beat in clinical trials. The reason that I point this out is that means it actually probably does better than we think it does. That it is a therapy that is associated with significant toxicities. But when one looks, the progression-free survival, overall survival data as we see for docetaxel, for really unknown reasons, have really improved a little over time. So I think that some of the negativism about subsequent treatments hopefully can be overcome. Some of these people can live longer than we think they will. At least that's what we've seen on clinical trial.
What is your thought about, hey, we progress on an IO. Can we go the ipi-nivo route as was done here?
So
CMB and PD-1 expression, plus or minus 50, less than one. How does that weigh in? And if you want to answer that once we get through the data, that's okay too.
Yeah, I think that so I have been very unclear about the benefits of ipilimumab and nivolumab after, if somebody's actively receiving, immunotherapy at the time of their progression. We conducted a study, several years ago, early in this, where we gave durvalumab and tremelimumab, which obviously are also now approved, in this approach, after patients had progressed on frontline PD-1 inhibitors, and almost nobody responded. And the data supporting ipilimumab and nivolumab in this setting is also really scant. So I think that there may be some patients, or for instance, in a case like this, that the patient maybe had been off for a while, that it may be a certainly a reasonable approach. But I would say there's not a lot of data that just to go to ipilimumab, nivolumab after progression on PD-1 inhibition achieves a tremendous amount. I think that we haven't talked much about the CMET. We can talk about that in maybe
once
after
we get to the data. Slides. Yeah, I think obviously in the days of everybody's getting complete genomic sequencing, things like CMET. What's the role of telisotuzumab vedotin in that space? So we'll get there. But okay.
So, this talk is sort of coming off almost disappointing developments in the idea of having a sort of across-the-board replacement for docetaxel. I'll explain that in a moment, but this was the TROPION-Lung01 study. This compared datopotamab deruxtecan to docetaxel. Again, the payload here is deruxtecan, but the antibody is directed against TROP2. You can see the primary endpoints for progression-free survival and overall survival. This is a positive study. It is a positive study because of the study design, which allowed a significant result for progression-free survival to to be enough to declare it a positive study based on, again, the statistical design. That was achieved, although the overall progression-free survival improvement was somewhat marginal. When one looks by histology, in the non-squamous disease, the benefits were considerably greater. And if you look in squamous disease, here the blue is docetaxel. It actually looks like there was relative harm in giving the antibody drug conjugate as opposed to docetaxel. There was a general safety, but again, there were AEs associated with death, again, generally interstitial lung disease. You can see here that that in the study arm, they had 7 events that an independent committee attributed to datopotamab deruxtecan, leading to death from interstitial lung disease. That is a rare finding. You don't see that much of it, but obviously, you know, even have a rare finding where it's associated with death is of concern. The one that you do see more frequently is stomatitis. And that is, again, something that has been sort of difficult for us in lung cancer. We really haven't used a lot of drugs that cause stomatitis. For those of you in a more general practice that treat breast cancer, things like that, there's maybe greater familiarity with this.
You typically use the dexamethasone rinse for that? I mean, in the trials, it seemed to make a huge difference, right?
The trials eventually allowed, and so like any new therapy, initially they want to see what do you need in terms of tolerability. But yes, the steroid rinse eventually was incorporated into many of these trials. And the overall survival was certainly disappointing. You can see the hazard ratio of 0.84 for non-squamous disease. Although a lot of this was driven by patients with actionable genomic alterations. This is a fairly new term that people have used and really is sort of defining a group of patients like those with EGFR mutations, ALK gene rearrangements, ROS1, RET. There is further development of datopotamab deruxtecan along with pembrolizumab, with or without chemotherapy. And this is sort of, as I alluded to, sort of disappointing news in this space, that basically, I won't go through all of the text, but this was originally submitted to the FDA as an approval for second-line non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer, but that basically has been withdrawn, and the focus now is going to be patients who have EGFR mutations. That group is based off of the TROPION-Lung05 study. This, again, is this group that had actionable genomic alterations. You can see the frequency of those, although in clinical trials it has generally been sort of EGFR mutations that are making up most of the patients in this group. And you can see that the waterfall plot looks quite good in these patients with actionable genomic alterations. Again, most of these patients had EGFR mutations. The benefit was a little bit less in those with ALK gene rearrangements, and the others, as you can imagine, are smaller subsets that you can't really go through. I do have one case of my own that I'll list because we don't really have sort of cases that would be approved. There's a 77-year-old woman. She was relocating to LA to be closer with to family. Originally diagnosed a long time earlier. So this is a patient with a long disease course, had actually been on first generation EGFR inhibition, and then eventually switched to osimertinib. At the time of progression, the patient did enroll on clinical trial of datopotamab deruxtecan. Again, the patient was in their later 70s at that point. Did have a difficult time with the mucositis originally, but with several dose reductions, she did well. This patient as well. Some of our other patients swear that they do better if they chew on ice chips, basically, during the infusion. Whether or not that's right or not, I don't know, but certainly that's what her sense was. The patient has done very well and continues to do well. So that's datopotamab deruxtecan. That is not the only TROP2-directed antibody-drug conjugate. Sacituzumab govitecan you also are familiar with, as this has several approvals in other malignancies. But the data here was also somewhat disappointing in lung cancer. You can see that this study was powered for overall survival. It did not meet its primary endpoint for overall survival. This also is being combined combined with immunotherapy. There are two cohorts you can see listed above in this EVOKE 2 study that are combining with PD-1 inhibition alone, and then also cohorts C and D that are combining with pembrolizumab and histology-specific chemotherapy. We've seen our first results from the chemotherapy combinations. Basically, this is substituting for pemetrexed in non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer for a taxane in squamous disease. And you can see the response rates and progression-free survival data is certainly reasonable, although also not necessarily a home run. We will await further data from this study. And now sort of antibody-drug conjugates, where we do think that the target is mattering. This is looking at Teliso-V or telisotuzumab vedotin. What you can see here are studies looking in EGFR wild-type patients. There was another study for EGFR mutation patients. For those who aren't familiar, there's been a significant story in the EGFR space of resistance by MET amplification, but this was for EGFR wild-type patients. Patients with either MET intermediate or high disease were treated with this MET antibody drug conjugate. The payload here is a little bit different, whereas deruxtecan is a trope is directed as a topo 1 payload. This is an MMAE and has more neurotoxicity, but less of some of the other toxicities that we've discussed. You can see the response rate data here in the overexpressing patients. You know, over a third of the patients having a response in the c-met high group, and duration of response was 9 months. There's a little bit of a complex slide, just shows the overall, which is sort of a combination of the low and intermediate, but just showing progression-free survival on the left and overall survival on the right, showing certainly I would say reasonable outcomes for this. As I mentioned, peripheral neuropathy tends to be the main toxicity of this. You can also see some significant edema. And there is a phase 3 study that is evaluating patients who have with MET overexpressing disease that is randomizing this versus docetaxel. So I think that we probably addressed and probably can move on if you're okay.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, so next case is Dr. Noble.
The next case is presented by Dr. Noble, a woman with limited stage small cell carcinoma of the lung.
She was in her 50s, you know, had smoked in the past, wasn't a typical small cell patient, eventually got imaging, a biopsy, proved to be limited stage small cell. Did really well with chemo radiation, had a great response. And then right after sort of the ASCO data came out, we kind of got her on IO after that. And she's doing well in remission.
She's on durvalumab, no tolerability issues with that?
Not so far, knock on wood. How do you incorporate that with PCI?
Any other questions about small cell?
Maybe some of the perineoplastics, if they are encountering any differences when you're using IO with that, if that somehow were to worsen that, or they see it more frequently, if there's any association. I think sometimes when you run into toxicities with the IOs and the patients that are PD-L1 positive and you're really trying to keep them on drug because you think they're going to get benefit, just kind of managing those toxicities. How much steroid can we give them?
Anything you want to hear them discuss about treatment if there's disease progression? There's a CD3 bispecific tarlatamab and the as yet not approved antibody drug conjugate infinatumab deruxtecan.
I think just toxicities would be great. And I think that's something we struggle with a lot in community practice. So I'd love to hear more about the specific toxicities. I think what they consider the ideal patient would be great when you would sequence it.
Yeah, I think, Dr. Noble and Neil Love both address these questions, but obviously we'd love to hear your thoughts about tarlatamab and then IDXD and the role there.
Sure. So maybe first I'll address the question about incorporating PCI, because I think that's a one that's hard. I will say that I personally have not been getting prophylactic cranial irradiation. I think there are conflicting data sets. There is a data set out of Europe that showed actually a survival benefit in extensive stage disease. But there was also a study out of Japan where they required MRI for everybody at baseline. And there it actually looked like there was a decrement in outcomes. The other thing that I once sort of suggested in this limited stage setting that you could omit it, my radiation oncologist at the time was sort of furious. That is, accepted, standard in radiation oncology. But if one actually looks at the data supporting prophylactic cranial irradiation in limited stage small cell lung cancer, it's a meta-analysis from, I believe, 2000 or 1999. So the patients, the studies from that meta-analysis were oftentimes like early 90s, our imaging was very different, and I think it's very hard to extrapolate that. So I've not necessarily incorporated that. That hasn't been a major, issue.
Skipping the tarlatamab, but what are your thoughts about the IDXD here?
Sure. So I think that the IDXD is another, deruxtecan-based antibody drug conjugate. The target here is B7H3, and this is, has been studied in small cell lung cancer. You can see that they evaluated 8 milligrams versus 12 milligrams. We can go here to the overall data, which shows that the response rate was higher with the 12 milligram response rate in previously treated small cell over 50%, which is really pretty good. Below, you can see the progression-free survival and overall survival data. Obviously, this is when you're looking at the comparison, it's basically two doses of the same drug, and outcomes were better with the 12 milligram. There was some increase in the toxicity there. You can see nausea was seen frequently, as was decreased appetite. There were some decreases in blood counts as well as part of this data set. This also is now being evaluated in a randomized study. The sort of established second line, topotecan, in many respects, is very similar to docetaxel, one of these control arms we all say is lousy and should be very easy to beat, but historically it has not been so easy to beat. Other options that are allowed here are amrubicin or lubrinectedin to allow for different practice patterns. So we will see randomized data in this setting. Obviously, clinically, this is a place where people are using tarlatamab, which, again, a T-cell engager. This, in lung cancer specifically, has made us a little bit nervous. We do have to hospitalize patients for the first cycle. On the other hand, for people in a more general practice, you're already often familiar with the toxicities here and may have a greater level of comfort. Although there are organizational issues of making sure that the hospital is set up for these admissions for the treatment, which can complicate things.
Yeah, particularly in the community, it's, having an appropriate SOP to manage those, but there's a little more experience on the heme side there. But it'll be interesting to see where the antibody drug conjugate versus the BiTE and the sequencing of those, how they play out, particularly keeping in mind the toxicities, including ILD, et cetera, and CRS. So, well, Dr. Guerin, I really appreciate your time today and insight. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.